What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with former FDNY EMT Yvonne Sanchez. Yvonne is a retired FDNY 9/11 first responder. She's also a cancer survivor and member of the Feel Good Foundation. She tells an amazing story about her time arriving at Ground Zero, dealing with the after effects, which included breast cancer, and her work to get the Zadroga bill passed. I think I'll just leave it there. And now I give you Yvonne Sanchez. Okay, I'm here with Yvonne Sanchez. Yvonne, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure and an honor. There's a lot that I want to get to, but before we do, could you please briefly tell our audience who you are and what you do or did?
Okay, I am retired New York City FDNY emergency response. My job then was body recovery and identification for the fire department. I was deployed down there for the entire duration of the recovery efforts, and I am now retired, so I can see anything with no repercussions.
And just to put a stamp on that, obviously you're referring to 9/11, Ground Zero, right, and the recovery right. effort that followed. So yeah, dialing the clock back then, Yvonne, can you describe the experience of getting the call about the World Trade Center? Where were you and what were you doing?
Okay. Yes, I was working that day. My tour started at 7, so that means you have to be logged into the computer 911 system and ready to work. Straight up, we call it straight out the box, I get a 911 job of a fallen. I recognize the address. We used to go there all the time to lift them, never to transport them to the hospital or anything. This time, he was the reason why I have to tell you this, because this is the only reason, he is the only reason why Engine 52 and Ladder 52 are still alive and I'm alive, is because this beautiful, kind, elderly man, very tall, stocky, 6 feet something. He was a promoter with something because all his walls were decorated with Muhammad Ali. I used to love going to his house. He lived in the Whitehall building, which is a very luxury building in Riverdale. When we got there, he had fallen and wedged himself between the wall and the toilet. And he obviously dislocated his hip. Excruciating pain. He was in his late 80s. So I said, we're going to take our time. And we had to cut the wall to get him out. So all that time, we didn't know what was going on in the world. And so we got him out. Fire had to use the fire saw and cut him out the wall. We had to shut the. So it took a while. It took more than an hour. And afterwards, we put him in the ambulance and we go to Montefiore, and then I see it in the waiting room, in the emergency room, like, and I thought it was a movie. I'm like, what movie is this, you know? And people crying, hysterical, and all this other stuff. And the triage nurse said, plane. And so when I was there, another plane hit. And then there, by the time we got there, so both buildings were down by the time I got there. And when we got there, with all the smoke and the haze and screaming and the fire trucks and the emergency sirens and all that, they kept telling me we couldn't get to a certain point, which was Chelsea Piers. I don't know if you're familiar with New York. So Chelsea Piers, after that, we had to go on foot. But you couldn't tell the difference between the Henry Hudson, where it ended, where was the highway, because all the gravel and the buildings and all that had pushed. So I couldn't see. So I was like, which way? Because I don't want a lousy swimmer fall into the Henry Hudson, because we couldn't see anything. And they said, just keep going straight, straight, straight. And that's when that's when I got to there. So I wasn't there for the building collapse. We were there afterwards. And at that point, for the first couple of days, I don't know how many days it was a rescue operation. And then it became a recovery. And so I was there from when it was a rescue. And so it's a rescue scene and a crime scene. So fire and PD do not mesh well in big MCIs because one thing's there, higher authority than the other. But when there's patients involved, fire department is the higher authority and then PD. But, you know, that was another posturing, like who department had the all that. We'll get to that. So we were using the American Express building as a makeshift morgue. So ask me a question after that. So the building's collapsed. And now all we're doing is at one point is fire, trying to put down, control the fire. And we were recovering anybody and transporting them out. You know, the train, number one train stopped because obviously it was under the World Trade Center. So there were, and then they were closing the bridges because they didn't know if there were more terrorists. And there, so the bridges were all being closed and they were, you know, doing point checks and all this other stuff. So a lot of people were going one way when we're going this way. A lot of New Yorkers, visitors, whatever, they were jumping into the river to get away from that. So that was a large maritime recovery effort where now, like the Circle Line and all that, were now helping recover all these people that were displaced and couldn't get out. I don't know if you saw the pictures of them walking on the bridge, Brooklyn Bridge. I remember one person, he's a sanitation guy. I don't know what happened to it. But I remember at Columbia Presbyterian, 168th Street, hearing that this custodian, he heard, and this is how I know Latins will survive the apocalypse because we're like roaches. You see something, they run. He said that they kept telling over the announcement speakers to go back to your office, that everything was under control. He was like on the 90 something floor. And he said he just ran and ran and ran. And he eventually made it to Columbia Presbyterian. He lost his shoes from running. He said they kept saying for us to stay. And he said he just ran and just kept going, kept going. And he eventually got treated for like lacerations and stuff at Columbia Presbyterian. Because, you know, the people were in the announcement speakers, they were saying that nothing was going to happen and that to go back to your office instead of evacuating. And then we were having triage from the channel on the stand. Triage was in the lobby of the World Trade Center. Now, if you have a plane hit, why are you doing triage in the lobby? Do you understand? Yeah. So there was a lot of stuff that happened. I think because we never expected something like that, we were unprepared, but it will never happen again because they go through so much now to prepare for an event like this that it's going to run, you know, hopefully never happens, but we are definitely prepared for something like that to happen now.
Yeah, absolutely, Yvonne. One question that was kind of occurring to me as you were talking, it might be a dumb question, but give it my best shot. Were you afraid as you arrived to the scene?
I thought we were at war. Now, I'm multiple generation, Marine Corps, military, they've been in every. And because we had the repeater, the antenna up on tower, I think it's 1-2, I don't know which one it was. It went down, so we lost all communication. We went back to regular writing on a card and going and passing it and doing it to the dispatch. So nobody knew what was going on. My cell phone didn't work. There was no landlines because everything fell. And so we were just getting communication from higher bosses. We didn't know how many this, that. And so at that time, I said, well, we're at war. You know, I couldn't reach my brother who worked for the Department of Defense. We couldn't do anything. So for the first, I was down there the first 2 days, 48 hours. Now, this is the way I think. When the buildings collapsed, I said, what the, you know, F. And I go, we're going to get blamed for this. We broke it. We're going to get blamed for this. And immediately I said, well, once I finish with this, I'm going to get my bug out bag. I had two girls in elementary school. They're going to be bullied. We're going to be cast as the worst department in the history of the universe because these buildings came down and we couldn't stop the fire department. And so I'm going to get my bug out bags and we're just going to go. I probably go to my other family in other countries or go wherever. I thought my career was over. I'm going to remove my kids because everybody's just going to blame them. That, you know, that look what your mom did and stuff like that. And that was totally the opposite. 48 hours later, they had MTA buses to bring us back to our stations, right? Because we didn't have any vehicles because everything was being used. I don't know how they knew that we were coming up the West Side Highway. Still brings chill. There were candlelight vigils and singing Ave Maria. And here I am thinking doom and gloom, we're going to have to get run, whatever. And here past Chelsea Piers, lining up the Henry Hudson with these camo individuals with signs saying, thank you. Look, it brings, I was like, and then right there I said, okay, we don't have to move. I don't have to quit my job. I'm a single mom. Because right now is immediate saving my children from being branded, you know, associated with me, that, you know, thousands of people died and the fire department failed in one way. But it wasn't, you know, we couldn't control what happened. It was about, it was going to come down. Just, you know, you had a plane. And, but at that particular moment, that's what you're thinking is like, oh, we broke it type thing.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was it.
That's incredible, Yvonne. I'd love to know, you know, if you could describe in as much detail as you feel comfortable, the experiences of shifting through the rubble and the nature of the recovery efforts.
Okay. The worst part during the entire time, and if you say, you ask anybody who was down there during the recovery effort, was the smell. Mm. The smell of burning materials from this building. It had asbestos, it had lead, because the paint, this building was built in the 70s, had lead paint. You had all the office equipment, and you have decomposing bodies, a combination in there with it. The smell was so bad that I didn't know, no matter what we did. At that time, we didn't have those OSHA respirators. We were just using regular simple face masks and carpenter masks. It wasn't doing anything. I was like, every minute I was like, where can I smell that I didn't have to? I just wanted 5 minutes not to smell that. Everything else, you know, it could have been dealt with. But the smell was in your hair, in your body, you were breathing it, you were ingesting it. And not only me, but when we would get off our tours, I mean, I would spend an hour in the bathroom regurgitating, going both ways. And it would be like this sludgy thing. And I wasn't the only one. And this is why so many of us either died or have cancer. Because Christy Whitman said, go buy your business, you know? And, you know, they had a open Wall Street, and the way to was to lie and say that the air was safe, and which wasn't, you know, it turned out it wasn't, and she should be prosecuted for how many thousands of people died from, not from the building, but from the exposure. And that is worse. And then I don't know whose idea was it, because there was no food there. You know, the water was contaminated. So you couldn't drink water. You couldn't prepare any water. All these stores were evacuated, but you had it. We had it be fed. We were working there 24. Some guy, I don't know who was it, but they put the spirit line, these like circle line, and they were feeding us there. But that was just diesel fuel, it was the motion of the ocean, and smelling that. And that was like right across from ground zero. And so there was my life. I couldn't eat. I would like be dying from. But that, I would say the worst part was the smell, and I hope that I never ever have to smell that smell ever again, because it's horrible, you know, it's unfortunate. But compiling those materials, lead paint, when it, I don't know if you ever smelled lead paint, it has this, yeah. And then you have the office machines and the gas that was in there. It was, that would be the worst part. That was the worst part for me. I mean, I can describe everything, and out of respect for the victim, I will never describe the conditions of these, because these were loved ones. And we treated them with the utmost respect. I remember going to the World Trade Center last year for the 20-year anniversary, and I'm waiting in a bathroom, and I just happened to meet somebody who said that she lost a husband. And I grabbed her hand, and I wanted to tell her, when we would find the remains, there were always religious affiliates inside the morgue, and they were performed last rites. They were never left alone. We treated every single one with the utmost respect that we were, because they were somebody's loved ones. And there was always, we always, it was a routine. We find, I would go, like I told you, I had canine assigned to me. Mm-hmm. So Bandit would sit, and then fire would cut the rebars and make it safe for us to recover the bodies. And then we would bring it to the morgue. And from there, I would pronounce, you know, where it was at, location southwest at the time and day. And then we would, then I would take it to the morgue, these makeshift morgues. And there we would go and see if we could identify them. But there was always three religious affiliates in there, whether it was a rabbi, Muslim, Catholic. They were all there and they would perform because we didn't know who they were. So we were, and then we would try to notify them. We'll log it into this big log. And then it would, then they would transfer either to the morgue. Those were civilians. For uniformed personnel, you knew that we shut down the entire site. We wait for the family to come. And then we have the honors processions up the ramp. And so everything was stopped. So those times that when we did later on, I would be with the remains of the uniform member until we were ready to do the procession.
Yeah.
Later, you know, after the big event.
Right, right. Understood, Yvonne. No, thank you. And I do want to get into your own personal experiences in just a few minutes here. But I would like to know, after your job was finished or your duty was done, can you maybe describe perhaps maybe the following week after your recovery efforts? How are you processing the event? Let's put it that way.
Well, I would say guilt death. I was alive and all my friends, one of my closest friends, we never found him. He was in the calendar with me, Hector Torrado. I was there every day because I wanted to bring him back to his family. He had five kids, lovely wife, and he was buried in an empty casket, which is mementos from him. So my thing was, how did I survive? Because I should have been dead. I was working at 7 o'clock in the morning. We would have been first. I worked in the West Side Highway. We could have been easily down there. So my whole thing was, I had to be treated with a psychologist for years afterwards because I had this guilt that here I am enjoying my life and they're not. And, you know, and that was the worst part.
Yeah.
Was the survivor's guilt. And then trying to go to as many funerals as possible and then go over there. And I don't want any pity. I'm just saying that we were all in level 10. Every single first responder that was responded there and the ones that came from other countries all over the 50 states. If it wasn't for them, they would take our part in the funerals and so that they would have a decent procession for the deceased to send them away and help us. I mean, the fire department could have never done that 10-month undertaking recovery effort. It's just impossible. I was like shocked and amazed and gratitude how many other, I heard like stories that there was a caravan and they got a police escort from each state to come up to help with generators and stuff like that. From Florida, one of my old that we worked in the same house transferred down to Florida. I turn around and he's leaning up against the post and I hadn't seen him in years. And he says, yeah, we had an escort all the way and we made it from Florida to New York. And he said in 16 hours because we were able to clear the streets because state patrol, state police had closed down the street so they could come up in this caravan. And he kept saying that it kept growing bigger and bigger as they crossed each state line, that more joined in. And we didn't know that because we didn't have televisions, electric, and stuff like that. And it was like, oh my God, you know,
right?
This is what it's supposed to be. This is what Americans are supposed to do, is unite when something like this happens.
Yeah, absolutely. Yvonne, I'd like to talk about your personal struggles following the recovery efforts. If my information was correct, it started with asthma, correct?
Right. I don't have asthma. I didn't have any of those diseases before 9/11. All I know is that I had retired soon after because I was severely injured. And they said, you know, you can retire. And I said, I'm retiring. And so I started getting asthma, my sinuses, and I think in 2005 to 2006, the World Trade Center started doing a World Trade Center monitoring. This is when they says, well, you have to get monitored to start a baseline to see what's going on. They did this study and they said, well, if people are exposed to these kind of carcinogens, this is what's going to happen. And that's how they came up with all this other stuff. Yeah. So I started getting asthma, sinus. I got two different types of cancer. I have World Trade Center lung disease. At one point, I was on oxygen all the time. I finally got some sinus stuff done. They said that, I forget what it's called, but it happens to fire lungs when they're exposed to carbon monoxide. Mm. They get like this lining in the sinus and they can't breathe. And a lot of them need the same surgery. And so they had to like put these drains too. And I started breathing a little bit better with it. So, and that's why, see, I was retired 3 quarters. I had no issue. But when Obama signed the World Trade Center bill, I said, well, you know, registered Republican, their uniform, their pro-uniform, allegedly. And when John Thiel and John Stewart came, I emailed them. I said, listen, I have a story if you want. I'm the first female to have breast cancer and this and this and this and that. And, you know, I have a brother who was exposed to the Camp Lejeune water. And so I said, I can help and say, well, this is what happened to my brother. That bill is forever. And it's the same kind of carcinogen exposure that was in the water. I said, so if you give it to the Marine Corps, to Camp Lejeune, and is it, then what is the problem with giving it to these people for a limited time? Because after 20 years, life expectation, you know, most people are going to die or whatever. And it's not going to be life because the Camp Lejeune bill is forever.
Right.
And this is only 20 years. What a reality check that I have with the Republicans in their offices, from being thrown out of their offices to be insulted to threatening to have the police come. And it was just like, and here are and I'm a registered Republican. I voted in the 2016 primary in the Republican Party, not Trump, but somebody else. Mm-hmm. And I was appalled. I was just appalled by the behavior that they have for us. The appall that we were asking for a handout and all we were wanting, because, you know, you have Red Cross there. These people, these Red Cross, the majority of them are retired. They came and left their safe state and came to help us, feed us, serve us, decon us. And that's what I would tell these politicians. It's not about uniform members. It's about everybody else that came there to assist us. We could have never done that. Red Cross had this, if from the beginning they were there, they were giving out food, McDonald's. I can never eat a cheeseburger again because McDonald's workers were giving out cheeseburgers, which we couldn't eat. There was no place to eat. These workers, and I would say that, these McDonald's workers didn't even have face masks. They're handing out bags of cheeseburgers and, you know, plain without cheese and Red Bull. They had Red Bull that I could never eat, drink Red Bull again. There were people giving out Red Bull. Restaurants would donate. All these people did it volunteer out of goodness of their heart. And we should take care of these people.
Yeah.
Because they were exposed equally as much as us. And even worse because, and that's why, I don't have it. I'm the spokesperson for healthcare for 9/11 with NIOSH. Mm-hmm. And they said that my face, because, you know, I was in everything down there. You know, I would sit there just that they thought the women were unassuming. And so there was a lot of pictures of me with a famous photographer, I guess, but I'm having Meyerowitz. Anyway.
Leibovitz? Dan Leibovitz?
Maybe. He was the one that documented the whole thing. He has an actual book with all the pictures. I'm in it. So they were illegals from the construction sites that were deconning the vehicles coming in and out, because they were trying to contain as much exposure. All those people and everything, they were exposed equally as much as I was. They were right there, civilians all walking around. And, you know, they believed that, yes, all these people were with us. And all these were retired senior citizens from, like, states that I've never visited are here. And they're serving us food, helping us decon. They would go around, give us hugs. There was emotional support. There were people giving massages. And so this is where
what's decon, Yvonne? Sorry to jump in. I'm just curious.
Decon is, they were trying to contain the amount. This is how they knew what was going on. Because they said that everything coming in out of the ground zero had to be decon. Meaning they had to hose down the wheels of the trucks, of the quads, ourselves. And we would have to go through that. Once we stepped out of the radius of ground zero crime scene, so picture it was quartered off for the crime scene. So you needed to have a badge. I think you I sent you, they have these badges.
Yeah.
So only those are the only people that were allowed in ground zero, including construction. John Field was there. He lost a foot.
Yep.
Or toes. And so anytime you stepped out of that area, you had to be decon. And these were these illegal aliens. And they would hose down the trucks, the wheels and everything. And we would try to contain it in this area here. So, yeah, that's what they would do. In order to eat in the tent, they had this thing where you had to go like silkwood. Yeah. And they would hose you down. Exactly. No, like silkwood, because I used to make that comment. Because she won an Oscar for that.
Right.
That it felt like, so, no, no more. It would joke, no, no more. And they would hold our gear, our bunker gear, our boots. And we had to decon in order to be in the kitchen. So that was like clue number five. You know, all this other stuff. This was all within the 10 months. That these are the stories I would tell the Republicans Party. Cruz and all that. Yeah. And this is what they would say. So why should the country put the bill for uniformed people to buy more shoes? Tell me that. And I'm like, what? We have three quarters. We're good. I'm here fighting the fight for everybody. I could live my best life and enjoy retirement for the rest of my life. I'm here because of the insult that you guys, you go, never forget. But yeah, you forget as soon as we're in front of you. You're like, you want to throw us out of your office. You treat us like the fly on a pile of shit that you stepped on. But, you know, and then after Rand Paul, now that's a special somebody. He's a real special somebody. And here you are. You go to the Democrats, that registered Republican since I was 18 years old. You go to the Democrats and they're hugs. Thank you for your service. Anything we could do, sign the bill. And I'm like, wait, what? I always, now mind you, uniform member. From my ex-husband to my side, Marines, they all fought in wars, law enforcement, all uniforms surrounded by blue, wore a blue uniform pretty much my entire life, thinking, yeah, the Republican Party is for, you know, military and all that. Half the people that were there in as far as PD were all like ex-military. And it was just, I was just like, I can't believe that we're still fighting for something.
Right.
13, 15 years later, when it's obvious that these people either died or not died. So it was like, it was a conspiracy. Everybody's lying. Like, no, that's not really happening. You know, we heard that. That's not really happening. That's all lies. You don't really have that kind of cancer. Yeah.
Right.
So
is it true that you didn't actually receive your benefits until as late as 2018? Did I get that right?
Yes. Yes. Yes, because obviously everything, the benefits from the victim compensation, yes. Yeah, it took a process. It took like 4 or 5 years in the beginning because there were so many people. And granted, a lot of people were trying to scam it. It's on the news, Google it. Especially in New York City, that people weren't there, uniform members. They were all arrested, something in Long Island. I think it happened in 2016. So 2017, two lawyers scamming. You know, World Trade Center benefits, they all got caught. There was the perp line. You Google it so you could see. You'll see everything. But I do want to tell you that I was just thinking about that. While I was doing my recovery efforts, right, there were a lot of people that came down. Tom Cruise, Goldie Hawn, the Prince of Spain. I actually shook hands with the Prince of Spain. 5 minutes later, I let go of his hand because they tell me Tom Cruise is here and they're asking you to give him an escort. I let go of the Prince of Spain's hand, my motherland, to go and now escort Tom Cruise down to the pit. He stood there at least 3 hours.
Really?
All that you hear about him being the nicest man alive, mm-hmm. It is absolutely true. Goldie Hawn, sweetheart. LeVar Burton. I'm yelling Kunta Kinte, and he's like giving me a hug. The entire cast of The Sopranos, Big Pussy, Furial. I'm like, McCain, may he rest in peace. I was there when the Bushes both President Bush, Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Tom, and Senator McCain. Senator McCain told me I was too pretty to be here. I love Senator McCain. He was, I mean, he is up there of like heroes in this family. And yeah, those were like the highlights of this nightmare, where there's like these people who genuinely had empathy and sadness for us going through that. And I had the pleasure of meeting them.
Wow. Yeah. That's incredible.
Oh, I just want to tell you.
Sure.
I did Tino Martinez on the Pitchers Mound. Tino Martinez, go Yanks. Their first game, because they invited us. You can Google that too. And yeah, I broke formation just to tell Tino Martinez that I loved him. And I hope he remembers me. But yeah. Go ahead. What do you want to say?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Thanks, Yvonne. Well, I'd like to actually ask you, who was Ray Pfeiffer?
Ray Pfeiffer was a fireman. First, he was construction, and he joined the fire department, and he was one of the first. I went to his funeral. That was with John Field. There were about 16 of them, and they would go with their O2 in their wheelchairs, and they would try to demo me. Now, you see a lot of pictures that the unions, oh, we're behind them. They never went into the offices. If we had the PBA, how many are they there? Could it and taken, but it was only like 30 of us. Toward the end, it was like 30 of us. In the beginning, it was John Field and 12, and about 12, 13 that would go in their wheelchair, oxygen, go there and go running. What we did, we were assigned. I was the recording secretary, and they were assigned, because it was only like three of us can go. And they would say, John Field will go, you go here, 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 and here. And we only have one day to do it. So we will go to Senate and then run to Congress, because we had a 45-minute meeting with them. And we would tell our story. And I would tell them, you know, my story. A lot of them got poor receptions. They didn't want to hear it. They're like, oh, you f-. And then a lot of them were like, oh, how can we help? How can we sign the bill? But those 30 of us, these 30 amazing people moved the mountain. And all of us were sick. We already got our three quarters. We were okay. We can go, like I said, and retire and be with our family. We left our family to go there to fight for everybody else. John Field, that man can cast the biggest shadow. John Stewart and, you know, Phil Alvarez. Phil Alvarez, I am 3 days older than Phil Alvarez. Marine, police, I'm fire. And yeah, I was there when, and I knew when he testified that I would never see him again, you know, and yeah, and we're the same age. I'm 3 days older than him. And at his funeral, I started having a panic attack. Like, I'm next. I mean, it took him down. It could take me down. You know, I was just like waiting for death to open the door and say, come on, you know, you, it's your time. And yeah.
Wow. You've sort of been dropping the names already, and I definitely want to ask you about it. Could you please tell our listeners about the Zadroga Act, John Field, the Compensation Fund, and John Stewart?
Okay. So the Zadroga Act was named after the police officer Groder, where they found glass and stuff in his autopsy. And that's when they decided to this bill, because his death, when they performed the autopsy and they found all this charred glass in his lungs and something. So, well, if this happened to him, obviously what we've been saying is true. And that bill started. And that's when John Field and all of them went out to and tried to extend the bill, because they ran out of money. And so we needed to extend the bill for medical and for compensation. Now, if people think that a person who can never work again, that $100,000 is going to take care of them and their family, they're completely lost. And so this is my point. So we would go to certain offices and say, oh, well, you're going to get compensation. I said, so you think $100,000 could feed a family for the rest of their life? Come on. Really? Really? Like, what's his face from Florida? Senator Scott. Lost all this money, but he's in a yacht in the Mediterranean, you know?
Right.
Perspective. He's one of those that, ooh, I mean, I would have to go, woo-sah. I mean, like, it was like, And they would look at me. One said to me, why should the country put the bill for you to buy more shoes? And I'm wearing sneakers. And I'm like, they didn't know who I was. And then I said, excuse me, I'm not a widower. And so I'm in this office with Richie Palmer, warden of downtown correctional facility, and one of his correction officer. They went to get up and do some damage. And I said, no, I got this. I read this man filth that he didn't know how to regurgitate those words fast enough. But yeah, I can prove that too. All this can be vetted because if it wasn't documented, it never happened. That's the motto of the fire department.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this whole thing is that I tell these young people is that you have to be proactive in voting your local politicians because this could be in your situation where here we are. And the next time to even get 30 people, to corral 30 people. And what? Oh, yeah. I was talking about the unions. Okay. So if you go back, and I hope people are listening, Google, because everything's Googleable, you would see PD, the unions of the New York City police are, oh, behind. We're going to make sure that this bill gets passed. But those heifers never went to any of these senators, to Congress, to lobby and get them co-signed. It was just these 30 people. Imagine if we had the unions behind us. This could have happened a long time ago. FD, the unions, all in front of the cameras. Oh, we're going to make sure this thing.
Right.
Where were they when we needed to get co-signers to sponsor the bill? They were nowhere. They would, and I tell everybody, they would take their union officials, go down to D.C. when we needed to go in front of the press, have $1,000 meal in these steak restaurants in D.C., do drink it up and all that, and show up for the press, and then leave. So they'll do that. And then once they do that, we, John Field's team, will go and talk after the press conference, go and speak to Congress and senators to sponsor the bill while they get back in their little vans and buses. I don't know how they got here. And go right back to New York. But the night before, they're yucking it up, drinking, having steak, because I was told that. And then leave soon after press. And you can Google all that, because if you see the documentary about the bill, there's several ones that are coming out. You will only see us, the ones with the white and black shirt and the tan. That's the John Fields team. And that was it. You don't see, they can't provide proof that we were talking to senators in their office again. They don't have proof or anything, but they said, we're going to make sure that we pass this bill. But where were they? And I would tell them, I told the PB New York, I said, why aren't you here helping us? If you had 30 of you, then it was 60 of us. Numbers count. But yeah, when you only have 3 people going to an office, how does that look? That looks like nobody cares. So why pass the bill? Right?
Right.
If you only have 3 people in the office representing thousands of uniformed members and civilians from World Trade, from that responded to World Trade, and you have 3 people instead of 60 people trying to fit into a room and being wall to wall, 3 sheets in, that speaks volume. But it wasn't. It was just them. And we were all 3/4 World Trade Center. We could barely walk up the hill to get into the Senate because, you know, you have to. And we were all singing, because from that age, that I'm just a bill. You know, we would sing. I would sing the song, I'm just a bill. And we would sing the song because it was like insane. And here they are, the unions, they're pushing us off the podium to speak to press and all that. But when the bill got signed, you know that they were all there taking credit for it. They were all there with the White House taking the credit for it. And we're all sitting there like, really? What exactly did you do? But
right.
It got Unreal. Passed.
Yep, yep, it did. And actually, that was a question I was kind of burning to ask you, Ravon. Were you there that day when Jon Stewart gave his now famous speech to the
Absolutely,
they did their jobs,
I'm
do
right
yours?
Behind him. You can see me. You can see me. I was there that infamous day. That here I'm crying, but you see me right behind them. And, you know, John Field said, do not say anything. Don't cheer. Don't do anything. Just stay there and watch. That's it. We couldn't say anything. And she says, just let them talk. Connolly, Phil Alvarez, and John Stewart. And that was it. I was right behind John Stewart. It was an amazing. I am forever grateful that I was part of history. And then I made a difference. They actually put my uniform in the Smithsonian.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And the picture, I can't show it to you because it's in the Smithsonian, but I'll send you an email so you can see it.
That'd be wonderful.
Yeah. They took my uniform, the picture down at World Trade Center that I thought it was going to be like a blip on a newspaper. You know, they said, oh, we're going to use your picture because your face is the most friendliest out of all the people. Because they were documentary. I'll get you and I'll email you so that you can. Anyway. So I said, sure. You know, anything to help. And then he goes, well, we're going to unveil it by the Ground Zero on this day. None of my family was there. My daughter was in college at that time. She goes, do I have to go? I have a class. I said, no, class is much more. It's the reason why I'm telling. So I show up there, press everywhere, all these people. And I'm thinking, what is this? I didn't realize that this was going to be like Sex and the City on the side of buses, in the train station, on the side of buildings. And on the bus stations and all that. And I didn't realize that this was how big this was. And I'll tell you a quick joke. Same day, my daughter was leaving class, coming home. She had the headphones on and she sees sitting on the train and she sees next to Dr. Zitzmore, which is a famous dermatologist that advertised inside the train station. She sees a picture of me and she goes, Mom, she comes back home after this because she didn't tell me how big this was. Like, what are you talking about? This unveiling, I would have gone. She goes, I made an idiot of myself. I'm sitting there minding my own business. I look up, I see your picture, and I start screaming, that's my mother, that's my... She used, you know, other words. And she said, people started clapping. She goes, that's my mother. She didn't realize. She knew that there was, like, this thing being unveiled. She didn't realize. She goes, so every day she would take the train to go to school, and every day she saw her mother up on above the thing where the advertising... I didn't even realize how big that was. But I am so happy that I was able, because it says that if you're even an illegal are entitled to health care if you were responding down there. And there were plenty of them down there that I got to know and I spent a lot of time with that helped me. And, you know, they were the ones that as soon as I stepped out the policeman, the crossing, I'm having a brain freeze. But as soon as I crossed over there, they were there in the entries and they would hose you down. And this was from the beginning to the end that they were down there, not including Con Ed, you know, construction, Red Cross, what do they call? Traffic agents. They were down there controlling the traffic. All these people were exposed to the same amount of time, the same with everything that I was down there, except we had respirators by that time because OSHA came in and said, oh, no, this water, this is unsafe. And it was mandatory that we had to wear these things, and that happened in December. So now you have September, October, November, and then December is when we had the thing. Because I have the card that says that I was fitted for it in December. Yeah, so we had 3 months.
Wow.
Just walking around thinking, believing the lies that people were saying that the, you know, that the air was fine and stuff like that, which wasn't, you know. And this is why more people died from the exposure than the actual victims of, you know, 9/11.
Yeah, it's unreal, Yvonne. I'd love to know, how are you doing now?
Well, I'm actually going for my World Trade Center monitoring next week. You know, we go for yearly physicals. And then every 6 months, I go to Sloan and I get scanned. And doctors every month that they had to look under the hood and make sure. I've had 20 surgeries on my back from the original injury down in 9/11. And then obviously I had double mastectomy and they had to remove them again because they thought they saw another lesion. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, thank you, Yvonne. And I think just in case we didn't cover it, the original injury, I believe it was rebar snapped off and hit your back, right?
No, we were inside the pit itself and we were, you know, removing one of the victims, and I didn't realize there were more around me, and I got spooked and I fell back and I impaled right here. And so they had, like, you know, we were all on 10, you know, and so I just thought that I needed stitches and needed to be clean, and I didn't realize. I know I was feeling pain, but I thought maybe it was because I was tired. I was working 24 hours, my back was hurting, the left leg was burning, and I didn't realize that afterwards, after the recovery effort was done and I went to an orthopedic and neurologist, they said, you pretty much have this amount of damage and you're going to have to get right with yourself that you won't be able to ever work again and do your line of work. Wow. And so then I have a spinal cord stimulator. I have plates. I have rods, you know, because it kind of like collapsed down and crushed the lower part. And so I had a drop foot. I had to learn how to walk again. And yeah, it was a lot. I had to learn how to swallow again after surgery. I had to learn how to use my arm after mastectomy because I lost some use of my hand. I can't raise it all the way up because they had to remove aggressive lymph nodes and stuff like that. Well, put it this way. This is how aggressive the cancers are for us. They said they found a little tiny spot, right? And they remove it and they said radiation. My gut said, nope, if I do radiation, I'm dying. And the holding my hand, no, 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 no. This was September. By December, after I had the surgery, you know, you have to wait. December, I went to Sloan Kettering. They did a mastectomy. She said, you had cancer in both breasts. And it went from stage one in 3 months to stage two everywhere in my lymph nodes. So had I have done radiation on just that spot, I would be dead right now. Because, but I knew as I sat in that office that I can't do this. Because if I do this, then because there's something wrong. So I always tell people, follow your gut instincts. If you feel like this is not the right thing, you need to have another second opinion. And yeah, they were all fighting and saying, you don't need a mastectomy. They removed it. It's fine. It's tiny. No, it was everywhere. It was like within, I think, 10 weeks, right? Less than 10 weeks. It was everywhere from the moment it started to that. It was everywhere. And that's what happens, you know, within 8 weeks, a lot of them are like, go from stage one to stage four. And now in hospice care, because it's aggressive. The cancers were aggressive because it's not, you know, and I also had that BRCA test and I don't have any genetic markers for cancer. And I had skin cancer and I had breast cancer. So, and they did that whole 12-step panel to see if I had it. And I had none. I had no genetic markers for cancer.
That's amazing, Yvonne. I see we're coming up on our time. What I wanted to do, Yvonne, if there was anything else that you wanted to say or wanted to make sure that you got out, I wanted to give you that opportunity now.
Yes. My thing is, people vote. Vote in your local elections because it matters. They don't think it matters, but go and vote. Because the stuff that we needed to do to pass this bill first, everybody else should have never happened. The amount of time that it took, more people died waiting for some form of help. That shouldn't happen. We're all Americans. We're here. You got to take care of us. That's it. Period. The end. That's where you're in office, is to represent us. Then do the job and, you know, and start the snarkasm. And yeah, that's it. And this is coming from a Republican, because I am a Republican, but I'm telling you, that party pretty much kicked us in the hiney. So,
yeah. Yeah. No, thank you, Yvonne. Actually, you know what? I did actually have one more question. My understanding, I think Michael O'Connell told me this, the Feel Good Foundation rings the bell for how many lives were lost that year. Do you know how many bells that was this year?
No. Okay. But I know that my name is going to be up there. It's going to be in the fire department and on the wall, and it'll be there when I die. It's because it is. So at least my death didn't, how do you say, wasn't a waste. And so then my family can see that when, like Connolly and all that, that our names will be, you know, to be remembered for what we did and our ultimate sacrifice.
Yeah, absolutely, Yvonne. Yvonne Sanchez, this was a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time for me.
I hope I filled in some of the gaps of what they didn't see, but I was in there as not as a firefighter, but as a EMS. And that was my job, was body recovery and identification. And thank you. I appreciate you hearing us, because I think that this has to be remembered so it doesn't happen again in the future. If, God forbid, we have another terrorist attack in this magnitude, that the country does the right thing.
I completely agree. You, John Feel, everyone, you certainly more powerful friends than me, John Stewart, and so forth. But all you guys can certainly count on me as a friend. If I had my way, I'd interview every last one of you and get your stories out. Who knows? Maybe one day.
I'll send you the link for the book if you want to buy it on Amazon. You can still buy it. And it has like the evolution. I think Giuliani commissioned him to do the evolution of the recovery effort. It's very enlightening. It'll help.
Awesome, Yvonne. Thank you so much again for taking the time for me, and I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.